We usually think that improving women's economic empowerment is going to naturally put upward pressure on the age of marriage or downward pressure on the rate of child marriage. And you just don't see that happening in Bangladesh.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. In the last decade, around 140 million girls will have become child brides in developing countries. Girls who marry very early are more likely to be socially isolated, have high-risk pregnancies, catch STDs, and be victims of violence in the home. Now, laws on underage marriage, not surprisingly, don't change much. But what does? An experiment in Bangladesh tried several interventions to encourage girls to delay marriage. Erica Field of Duke was one of the researchers, and she's here today to tell us about what worked and what didn't. Erica, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Thank you, Tim. Thanks for having me.
These are very high numbers, aren't they? And I guess the girls who marry very young are going to live with the impact of that decision for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, I think that's one of the challenging aspects of doing research on this topic is that we think that the negative effects and the consequences of child marriage are effects that one observes throughout a woman's and her children's lifetime. And so we really don't have very good measurement of the harm that is possibly done or not done, measurement at all of this problem and the impacts. And so that's one of the goals of our research has just been to try to measure the negative impacts of child marriage.
Why do girls marry so young?
And that is, I would say, the second goal of the research is to try to better understand what must be some positive incentives for families to marry daughters young. And so our experiment tries to isolate some of the possible reasons that we might see this persisting. One important piece of background information I would give on this setting, which is in Bangladesh, where child marriage is very high, is that it's curiously, in our minds, also a setting in which you've seen a lot of positive improvements for gender outcomes over the past couple of decades. You've seen big gains in women's labor force participation. You've seen enormous improvements in female schooling and adolescent girls' schooling outcomes. But rates of underage marriage, there are various definitions we could employ, but we tend to just look very simply at the rate at which girls in a certain cohort are getting married below age 18, which was the legal age of consent in Bangladesh. Mm-hmm. That has stayed pretty constant while these other improvements in female outcomes have changed. And that is a very interesting puzzle for social scientists, because we usually think that improving women's economic contribution to the household or economic empowerment is going to naturally put upward pressure on the age of marriage or downward pressure on the rate of child marriage. And you just don't see that happening in Bangladesh. So that led us to think about other possible reasons why this institution was persisting. So we think about, a lot of anthropologists have pointed to the desire for societies to regulate female sexuality, the need for families to keep daughters at home and not have them earn their own keep, so girls are expensive. We also look explicitly at dowry cost. When we interviewed households and kind of talked to them somewhat informally about why they continue to practice early marriage, there was a perception that if you delay marriage for girls, it becomes very costly in terms of how much you have to transfer to groom's family in order to marry an older daughter. Now, this could either be driven by a compensation. If a girl is older, she has to pay more in the marriage market in order to be able to marry the same quality husband. It could also be that older daughters have different preferences. Perhaps older girls have more agency or are more educated because they marry later and therefore want to marry someone who's more educated or marry a different kind of groom who has higher income. So that it's a little bit hard to separate differences in who older girls or young women marry versus just financial cost of delaying marriage. And so, we try to look at both of those hypotheses, but then also just examine what if you compensate families for the cost of marrying a daughter later, wherever that originates, is that going to ease that financial barrier to delaying girls' marriage? So we also learned from these interviews with households that families did express desire to marry daughters later. At the same time, they said it wasn't feasible. Now, sometimes people will say that as a way of rationalizing their own behavior. We'd really like to do this. We know it's right, but we can't. But it's theoretically possible that it's an understanding of the costs of child marriage, but an inability to change practices because of financial constraints.
Based on all of this, you began an experiment encouraging girls to delay marriage. I think you began it in 2007. I suppose to find out what works in an experiment like this, you can't just look in a few months or a year later. How long did you run this for?
We are still collecting data. So you're correct that the experiment started in 2007. We first had to do a lot of work to identify, you know, who we would treat with these interventions. Ideally, you'd like to tell parents that you have an 8-year-old daughter, and we're now going to give you financial incentive to afford to keep her unmarried until she's of legal age, because then they might invest more in that girl's schooling from an early age. But that's a very costly experiment to be, I mean, in terms of time. You'd have to take, you know, parents of girls who are 8 and then wait until they're 18. Then you have to wait until they get married, which takes another 5 years for everyone to wrap that up. And then and then if you want to see the impacts, you want to see the impacts on things like age of childbearing, on number of children, on child outcomes. The benefits, there's so many possible things that could change when a woman marries later. She's just mechanically going to delay childbearing, which in a certain age range we think is good. She's going to space children more. So even if she has, you know, has a child when she's 20, she's more likely to wait more to have a second child. Her economic contributions to the household might go up because she's attained more education. So we want to see enough history of her labor force participation, her agency in the marriage, her ability to influence choices over expenditures in the household. It could also change. Domestic violence, you know, a lot of marriage outcomes could change. So we want to have enough of a window in the marriage to observe differences in outcomes for the woman and her children. And so if you started the experiment when she was 8, you'd want to wait till she's 28, you know, to really get a good impact, because some of the girls won't marry till they're 25. Now, that's a 20-year experiment. And not only are we generally impatient about doing something for that long, but it's hard to track people over that kind of period. What we've done in this experiment is we introduced these programs to delay child marriage among girls who were 15 to 17. We were working in 3 rural districts of southern Bangladesh, and that seemed to be at that point in time, the kind of critical window. You do have some girls marrying before that, but very few girls were marrying before 15. About half of girls were waiting till 18, but that's still a high rate of child marriage. So, or adolescent marriage, I should say. So a huge chunk of girls were marrying at 15, 16, and 17. 16 and 17, really. What we kind of hope to achieve is to, in very simple terms, is push girls from marrying at 16 to 18. That's kind of a small difference in age of marriage, statistically speaking, but it could be a very important one in the sense that that's when girls can complete secondary school. And I'm not a psychologist, but in terms of adolescent development, I think, you know, that just physical and mental formation and skills acquisition happens over that period. And so we tend to think that a lot of development happens between 16 and 18 that might be best nurtured outside of marriage. That gives us a little shorter time period. But we're still talking about, you know, intervening when girls are 16 or 15 at the earliest, then waiting for them to marry up until kind of 25 is when the last girls are marrying. And you really want to get everyone married because you want to observe all of the delays that happen and then not have your sample falling over the course of the study. So we went back, actually. We tracked girls right after the intervention to see how many married as adolescents or were still unmarried by the time they were 18. Then we went back for a second round once most of them had married. There's a little bit of an age range because girls were between 15 and 18, but they were kind of 22 to 25. And so we have marriage outcomes and we see that we affected marriage and whether or not women had initiated childbearing is an outcome we look at. And we're actually going back next year to collect data on child outcomes and a richer set of outcomes about women's labor force participation and economic empowerment and marriage outcomes like domestic violence. As long as we observe differences in benefits and we believe there are more benefits that might accrue over time, we'll keep seeking follow-up studies to keep track of this large cohort of girls that participated in our experiment.
Tell me about the interventions, the programs that you provided here.
So we essentially did a what we call a horse race between two types of interventions. The first was at the time, and I believe still is, kind of the most common heavy-handed tactic to reduce child marriage. I say that because most countries have age of consent laws, which are laws about at what age a child can get married, which outlaws it except under exceptional circumstances or what, you know, every country's a bit different. But the fact of the matter is that in most settings in which this is common, they just are not enforced or enforceable. But you know, basically, age of consent laws are symbolic and maybe important, but they're not a way to really deter the practice. What NGOs and governments, but mainly NGOs, have been doing recently is enlisting girls in usually economic empowerment programs that focus on skills acquisition and make them more independent and less reliant on marriage and hopefully increase their agency and ability to speak up for their own rights. And governments have also encouraged female schooling participation that's often conditional on remaining unmarried as a way of deterring child marriage. What we hypothesized was that while these may be very, very important for girls and likely beneficial, when you have a culture of arranged marriage in which adolescents themselves are largely not part of the group of decision makers over marriage, even boys, I would say. I mean, I think it's really in much of South Asia and especially rural Bangladesh, really an arrangement between families and parents. The degree to which you give young girls agency or ability to earn income of their own is not necessarily going to influence when they get married, but the timing of or who they marry, because they don't have that kind of influence over that specific life choice. I think that's not true in other countries, other parts of the world, where the people getting married aren't quite so outside of the arrangement. I think there could be more direct effects of empowerment on outcomes, but we thought that this kind of program is not likely to change rates of child marriage. So at the same time, we would run a parallel program that provided parents of daughters financial incentives to delay their daughter's marriage until 18, to basically abide by the law. As long as your adolescent girl remains unmarried, we're going to help you pay for the additional cost, because this is what parents had told us was their constraint. And so we introduced this. It's a financial incentive or something that helps them pay for that cost. So in some set of villages, girls only get the empowerment program. In some set, they get only the financial program. And in some, they get both. And that allowed us to see which of these approaches works for which outcomes. Is there a complementary effect of providing these programs together? Does one seem to be more effective in just achieving this one outcome?
How did you know that your results were accurate, that people were telling you the truth, especially because there's a financial incentive involved?
Yeah, that was very tricky and could be trickier in some places. You know, one thing we relied on is the fact that traditional marriage arrangements involve a girl leaving her parents' community and household, certainly their set of extended family households. This is a setting in which there's exogamous marriage practices, which means that daughters don't stay within the extended family. They leave the family and usually leave the village and move into their husband's household. And girls of that age don't really leave the household otherwise. they're very limited, have very limited mobility around age 16 or 17 when they're the age of marriage. And so finding the girl at home is a pretty good indicator that she is unmarried. Mm-hmm. And especially if you don't tell a family when they're coming, if you kind of do an audit study of, we're going to knock on the door. And if you say she's unmarried, she's going to come home soon or be around. If a girl's unmarried, you can find her pretty easily at that age. To get the incentive, the girl has to show up in an audited style fashion. You know, you have to be able to find her at home. The one thing that might happen if families were really strategic or, you know, really keen on getting the financial transfer is they could marry a girl and then delay when she moves into her husband's household. You do often see young people getting married and then waiting a few months to start the household together for the girl to move in. We decided that that was a good enough approximation of delayed marriage. Mm. Because the real benefit is about being in her home environment, close to her school, not having to stop schooling, not being controlled by people that she doesn't know very well, who might treat her as kind of a domestic servant when she's very young, remaining in that environment in which she was raised. We also did other kind of checks of asking neighbors and asking the community health workers who was married and who wasn't, and looking in official registrars of marriage.
So how strong was the effect of each of these interventions on your primary outcome, which is the age of marriage? How much did it affect that?
It's a bit difficult to summarize quickly. So I'm going to say it in a way that may not be exactly what you would expect me to say. So
okay.
This is the hardest part, I think, of talking to people about the size of the effect. So let me first say the basic pattern of results is that the financial incentive you see a strongly significant difference across the villages in which girls were offered the incentive and villages in which they were not, a significant difference in the rate of underage marriage, both the rate of marrying under age 16 and also the rate of marrying under age 18. And you don't see that effect on age of marriage of the education program alone. And you also don't see a complementarity between the two programs. That is, the rate of reduction in child marriage is similar in all financial incentive villages, whether or not they participated in the empowerment program. That doesn't mean there aren't additional benefits of the empowerment program. It's just that they didn't have any kind of additional impact on child marriage. How much people were influenced. There's a limited scope. We're looking at marriage below 18, and we're giving incentives to girls who are 16 and 17, essentially. Only girls who are not yet married. And so a lot of the adolescent marriage that takes place has already taken place. And the 17-year-olds in our program can only delay marriage by under a year because the incentive stops when they turn 18. And so what I like to say is that our results are consistent with virtually everybody taking up the financial incentive as long as they were eligible. An estimated 95% of the people who were 17.5 delayed marriage for half a year. And girls who were 17.0 delayed marriage for almost a year. And girls who were 16.5 delayed marriage for almost a year and a half. If you average that out, it ends up being a small change. But that's because half the people that we treated would have waited until they were 18 anyway. So that's the first thing you have to realize, is that you could be implementing this policy in a setting in which everyone is at risk of child marriage, but we know from the control group that half the sample is not even at risk. So that's kind of a cost of any of these programs, is that you have to give an incentive to people that didn't need to be incentivized. Mm. That's also going to lower the impact, because there's no impact on those people. Half the people are going to have zero effect when they're compared to the control group, because they were people whose parents weren't going to marry them below 18. And then the other half only gets the incentive for a little bit of time. And so you can do a kind of back of the envelope calculation, and it looks like compliance is very, very high. It looks like most people will take up the incentive if we offer it and delay marriage. People who are going to marry their daughters when they're 14, those are kind of more extreme cases. They have either more dire need or more extreme beliefs about tradition or appropriateness of girls waiting. They might not be treatable, but among girls who are unmarried at 15, 16, 17, if you offer them a small financial incentive, they seem quite willing to delay until 18.
Have you seen a similar effect on the other things you were looking at, things like the age of the first pregnancy or how long they stayed in school?
Yes, there is a corresponding increase in schooling outcomes. And so girls who delay marriage also get more school. It's not surprising here because school is free for girls. There are no fees for girls in Bangladesh right now. There are always costs of getting to school. And there's the time cost. You can't participate in agriculture, or, you know, helping in the house if you're in school. So there are some costs of schooling, but there aren't financial barriers to schooling. There are very important mobility barriers in the sense that it can be considered inappropriate for girls who are of marrying age to walk alone, for instance. So those barriers may mean that girls, even when they're not married, might be kept at home and not sent to school. What we found is that a large fraction of girls who are still in school when we treat them, haven't dropped out yet, continue in school if they're incentivized to not marry. And that's great, because that's, you know, an added benefit of delayed marriage. And one of the main reasons that we should care a lot about child marriage, I think, is that we know from other settings, we know from non-experimental studies, that it contributes to lower schooling attainment of girls. And we did confirm that in our study, that these girls are more likely to stay in school and get higher education. What's interesting is that the empowerment program seems to contribute independently to that. So the empowerment program itself alone seems to encourage girls to stay in school, even though they don't change their age of marriage. So what that means is that girls in the empowerment program who were going to wait to marry are also less likely to drop out of school early. Even though it's the same outcome, it seems to be affecting a different set of girls, the two different programs.
Is it possible to put a financial value on the benefit of doing this so we can do a sort of cost-benefit analysis, considering that you're paying financial incentives out?
We try really hard to do that. And certainly there's a demand among policymakers for that kind of summary statistic. But I do think it's useful to be able to translate magnitudes of results in that way. It's just really hard because so many of the benefits are hard to put financial values on, especially we just don't have the information on things like maybe it lowers child mortality. We have to measure that carefully over a woman's lifespan. We haven't done that. The simple way we did that exercise, and it's considered a lower bound found on this number is to say, well, the one thing that's really easy to observe is schooling completion, because most girls don't go back to school when they're 30. You know, they might keep having kids until they're 40, but we think that we've seen final schooling attainment, and we can assign a number. That's not an easy exercise, but we can say, what are the financial returns to schooling for women? And that's based on labor market participation and wages and the number of hours that a woman is projected to work over her lifetime. So we can say, what are the economic returns only in terms of wages, a woman's wages of delaying marriage? Now, that is a very conservative estimate of the benefit, because I think of that as a small fraction of the benefit of delaying marriage. I mean, it's true that women are expected to work more and earn more wages and earn more income as a result of attaining more schooling and possibly also of marrying later. But, you know, there are so many other benefits that we think are likely there that I really have a distaste for reducing it to that one thing. But at least that is one thing that we can measure. So it's kind of hard to argue with. If we started trying to say, well, let's assign a financial benefit to having more control of consumption in the household, I don't know how you would really calculate that in a meaningful way that would be satisfying. And so we are agnostic about all the other benefits. The human rights benefits, obviously, is something that we think are extraordinarily valuable that we can't put a number on.
This seems like extremely hard work that you've put into this, Erica. So is an intervention like this scalable? Can you roll this out across more than a few communities?
I think it's actually increasingly scalable. A big part of our difficulty in setting up the program is, how do we deliver these incentives to households mechanically? How do we get these households? Like, what kind of distribution system do we have to set up? But increasingly, people are receiving public benefits, including this kind of transfer digitally. And I think that vastly improves governments like Bangladesh's ability to make financial transfers to households. Rural households across South Asia are banked at pretty high rates now, meaning you can make transfers into bank accounts, even to adolescent girls. And then better and better systems of personal identification that include age verification. That's also something that's happening throughout South Asia. We're getting personal IDs, you know, fingerprint IDs on everyone. And, you know, young people are very likely now in rural areas to be registered in some capacity in a way that would allow you to verify their age. Not perfectly, but much better than you could a decade ago. And so I think those two innovations in stronger government institutions in terms of record keeping and redistribution make these programs very, very scalable.
Well, good luck for the future with that then, Erica. 13 years and counting, still going strong with that one.
Thank you, Tim.
Thanks for coming to explain it to us today.
Of course, very happy to share.
Now, the working paper that's come out of this is called The Effect of Conditional Incentives and a Girl's Empowerment Curriculum on Adolescent Marriage, Childbearing and Education in Rural Bangladesh, a Community-Clustered Randomized Controlled Trial. And the authors are Nina Buchman, Erica Field, Rachel Glenister, Shahana Nazneen, Svetlana Pinkina and Iman Sen. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. If you enjoyed it, subscribe on your podcast platform and you will never miss an episode. Or you can find past episodes at voxdev.org.